everyone. Welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Nuclear Law and Policy Team at the Center for International Law, or CIL. Today's podcast is on radioactive waste management and multinational repositories. I am Nivedita. Together with Denise Cheong, we will be joined in conversation by our special guest, Dr. Charles McCombie, an independent, strategic, and technical advisor to numerous national and international radioactive waste management programs. As part of this podcast, Dr. McCombie will offer his views as to whether deep geological repositories offer a sustainable solution to the management of radioactive waste, and in particular, the opportunities as well as challenges surrounding the multinational repositories. Dr. Charles McCombie is currently the president of the Areas Association and serving in the secretariat of the ERDO Association. Both Areas and ERDO Associations are organizations that focus on enhancing multinational cooperation at the back end of the fuel cycle. He has extensive experience in radioactive waste management, including 20 years as the Director of Science and Technology at NAGRA, the Swiss Waste Management Organization.
A very warm welcome, Charles, to Nuclear Matters at CIL. It's indeed our privilege to have you join us today for a discussion on radioactive waste management and multinational repositories. Before we turn to the topic of multinational repositories, I'd like to start with a broader question, if I may, Charles. And the question is this: radioactive waste management has often been touted by critics as being one of the most pressing issues that stands in the way of a wider deployment of nuclear power. In this regard, Charles, do you think that deep geological repositories are a sustainable long-term solution? And if so, in what way?
Good question. Well, I definitely think that the deep geological repositories are a sustainable solution, but maybe I should say, first of all, which definition of sustainable I'm using, because it's kind of much misused term nowadays. I think the best definition of sustainable is the one that the Brundtland Commission put out, which most of you are probably familiar with, I think. To quote, if I look down, meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. That's a very good definition. What does that mean for waste disposal? Well, first of all, it means that waste disposal must be safe, yeah, and secure. And in my area, we tend to use these two words differently. Safe is usually referring to radiological safety, short-term and long-term. Secure is referring to proliferation issues. So it should be safe and secure. To be safe, it's got to keep the waste isolated from a really long time into the future. And as I will point out later, I think it does that. It can isolate, so the humans on the surface of this planet will not be bothered by radioactive waste if the job is done properly. Secondly, if the job is done properly, we will not alter the Earth. I think this is the most overlooked part of all. Deep geological repositories, even if there are several of them, which I hope there will be one day around the world, future generations will not be bothered by them if they are done in the proper place, in the proper way, and with the proper technology. We will not change the surface of the Earth, as opposed to I am horrified still today by how we change the surface of the Earth by large-scale mining, where we remove whole mountains or build whole big deep holes, where we're polluting the atmosphere in ways which could change the Earth forevermore. All of these things make the issue of a few or several deep geological repositories 500 meters or more down in the ground in geological formations which have been stable for 100 million years, then that's not a big issue to get alarmed about, to try to predict, if that's the right word, that this environment will be stable for another 100,000 years. Let's choose 100,000 years, yeah? You know, I have often said a bit, maybe trivially, that predicting 100,000 years of stability in a 100 million year old geological formation is kind of parallel to standing out in the sunshine for 12 hours and predicting that the sun will shine for another 1.5 to 2 minutes. Yeah, it's not a large-scale extrapolation. So that I think we are not leaving the world behind in any significantly altered way for future generations. And the last part of sustainability, we are not placing a burden on future generations, even quite immediate future generations, with three provisos there. The provisos are that we give them the technology to implement deep geological repositories. And personally, I think the technology is there today. We have to give them sites where it can be done. And that's, we'll come to that, I'm sure. That's probably the most difficult thing. But if we can also indicate sites which are geologically, environmentally, and societally, the last most important thing, acceptable, yeah, that's the second criterion. And the last criterion, which is important, is that we have to leave the financing there so that responsible nuclear programs set money aside, like nowadays most of them do, some took a long time to do it, so that the funding will be accumulated even if you implement the repository in 10, 20 or 30 years, which many advanced programs are talking on these timescales. So if we provide the technology, the siting and the financing, then we are not placing any undue burden on future generations. And if you take these three aspects which I put together there, the safe and secure aspect one, don't alter the surface of the earth, the human environment in any significant way, and provide the technology and the financing. So a long answer, but I think it's a really important question. So I think that deep geological repository as part of the nuclear power cycle is definitely a sustainable solution.
Thank you very much, Charles, for that very comprehensive response. And my one comment that jumps to mind, and this may be a simplistic one, is purely from a land usage point of view, is this something that still gels with the definition that you raised about sustainability, or the definition that you've used for sustainability?
Yes, it's a question of scale. Of course, nuclear or deep geological repositories will use very little surface land, trivial amounts compared to any other energy technology that there is around. You know, a nuclear power, which you can't really separate the two. You know, nuclear waste repositories are a component of using nuclear power. So that, to be fair, you should also look at the land impacts of the nuclear power before you get to the other part. But even then, nuclear power, the land impacts, of course, it's one of the most compact energy production sites. You know, a single 1,000 megawatt reactor, such as all around the world are, you have to replace it with several square kilometers of solar cells or with 1,200 windmills, all of which, so that the surface impacts of the nuclear power part are relatively small, and absolutely small as well, I think. And for the deep geological repository as such, of course, since you only have surface workings and everything else is deep underground in areas which will never be impacted, never be touched again by humans, then I do not think that is a major issue compared to the many other issues.
Speaking of deep geological repositories, I mean, the latest news that we've heard is Finland in Europe is actually in the process of constructing the world's first DGR, or deep geological repository. Similarly, its neighbour, Sweden, is also considering a deep geological repository, but facing some delays in their plans. So seeing that both Finland and Sweden are neighbours, it raises the question whether there's a place for multinational solutions, in particular multinational repositories. that could actually help countries like Finland or Sweden in those that are in close proximity. In this case, before we go on to the specific issue, how would you actually define a multinational repository?
That's good. The second question is easier. The definition of a multinational repository is really clear to me. It's any repository, deep geological, could also be surface, but we're talking deep geological today. Any deep geological facility which it contains waste from more than one country, even two is enough, yeah? But more than one country. Because as soon as you dispose of waste from another country, then all of the problems and all of the challenges are there. So it doesn't really matter if it's more than one country or just two, yeah? So that's the definition of a repository. Inside this facility, there is waste, the radioactive materials that were produced in more than one country. Yeah. Now, the issue of multinational, of course, I spend 50%, I think, of my life for the last decades plus on the multinational issue. And, of course, I strongly believe that, these are not just useful, but may well be necessary. And not just for adjacent countries. In fact, the transport of radioactive waste is not a huge issue. One is that it's safe. It's never had any significant accidents transporting even high-level radioactive waste or spent fuel. And as you're aware, this stuff has been transported between Japan and France and Britain and America and so on. So transport is not a big issue. Also, cost-wise, it's not the major issue there. So I think multinational repositories can, should, and I hope will be an important element for many countries. The most important driver is not the proximity, I think, but the size of their waste inventories. Small countries can have a job. A deep geological repository costs roughly the same as a nuclear power plant, yeah, in round numbers, 5 billion or something. Even this small one, like the Finnish one, which is on the way, is going to cost a few billion euros, yeah. So that's the starting price. And most of that is starting price. The costs for a deep geological repository involve the cost of all of the surface preparations and work and analysis and getting down to depths with the repository and then starting making space underground. These are all what we call fixed costs, yeah? The marginal costs are then mean making more space down there. And these marginal costs are very much lower, of course, than the fixed costs. So that's why there's economies of scale are really important for small nuclear programs, small and new nuclear programs. So that inside Europe, for example, we have countries like Slovenia, which has one and might have a second nuclear power plant, or the Netherlands, which has had two nuclear power plants. And for them, there's a real economic advantage in having a combined facility because of the economies of scale that are involved. Multinational repositories have to come in the future. In Europe, where I live, we need 29 or 30 different deep geological repositories if there are no shared multinational solutions. And the last point I would make there, when I say 29, that's not because there are 29 nuclear programs in Europe. There's less, there's half of that, maybe 15. But what people often forget is that any country which uses nuclear technology of any kind generates some amounts of radioactive waste, which today the only way we can dispose of these safely is in a deep geological repository. And that's why in the, we can talk later about the organization ARIUS and so on, but in the groupings that I work in, then the driving countries include not only small nuclear countries like Slovenia and the Netherlands that I mentioned, but they include also Denmark and Norway, neither of whom have nuclear power. In fact, in Denmark, adamantly opposed to nuclear power. But in Denmark, they have run fairly intensive research reactors, and they have they're in the unfortunate position in Norway or in Denmark of having a few hundred kilograms of radioactive waste that will be active for the same time, for 10,000 to 100,000 years. How do you get this material into a safe final resting place? As I said, the only safe final resting place we know of today is deep underground, since we've written off shooting into space and so on. And the only way they'll be able to do it is to be part of a joint project. So I think that the MNR multinational repository, the abbreviation we use, is important and will be important also in the future.
So Charles, aside from the economic viability, what else forms part of the value proposition for MNRs?
I don't think you should be doing things which are potentially must be done well and potentially hazardous just for economic reasons. But there are much higher level justifications or challenges also. One is that it's safe and secure, the words I used earlier. And that's a global issue. Nuclear is global. You cannot have national safety and security only in isolated countries. Yeah, if the waste is not looked after properly in one small country surrounded by other countries, then it's a problem. So I'm talking global safety and global security. Yeah, the other aspect there is that the on the way to realizing a shared multinational repository, there are huge benefits in terms of sharing technology, sharing know-how, sharing experience, sharing personnel, which we are now arranging in Switzerland, so that a small country has a problem even to have a radioactive waste management team that covers all of the necessary aspects. So radioactive waste management is why I'm in it. It's wonderfully multidisciplinary thing, ranging from physics to chemistry to engineering to biology to zoology to cover all of the aspects that have to be covered, then you need a large team. What can a country like Slovenia do where the total radioactive waste management team is a few people? Yeah, they can't do it. So you have this idea of sharing expertise, and I think that's really important. And of course, as I say, the economic benefits to all of the sharing countries are the most obvious, perhaps. And within that, maybe many people think that the driving force might be that the economic benefits, in particular to the country that acts as host, might be a driving force to move that ahead. Yeah. So these are all, the potential benefits of that. The challenges that you're kind of also referring to is, the biggest challenge is obviously siting. You know, siting, mentioning acronyms, I don't like acronyms, with one exception. I like one called a LULU, L-U-L-U. This is an American acronym which means a locally unwanted land use, a LULU, but it's a good acronym because it sounds bad, and it is bad, and it's because people don't want them, and they don't want it if it's any kind of waste facility. They don't want a garbage dump near them and so on. So that the idea of NIMBY, to use a well-known abbreviation, not in my backyard, is the hardest thing to get over. And citing even national radioactive waste repositories, as you are well aware, has been really, really difficult. And it was tried in very, very bad ways by my generation of nuclear people who took a long time to learn, you know, that there's more to life than just plain science. You know, beat them on the head with enough science and technology, it's okay. But nowadays, the citing of national repositories, for example, the only successful ones have been done on a consensus basis, yeah? So that in Finland, that you mentioned at the beginning, then the local community agreed to have it because they weighed the potential advantages and the potential disadvantages and came to a positive decision. In Sweden, which we like to talk about, as you may well know. There was competition at the end. There were two host communities, both of whom really wanted to host this community because they trusted the people building it. They believed it was going to be safe and so on forever. So there was competition. And this is the nice part of this story there, that in the end, you can't build it in two different communities, so one had to be chosen. So they chose one. And in the meantime, a sizable fund had been allocated to give some benefits to the program, yeah? And at the time of the decision, the fund was divided. And the biggest part of the fund went to the community which did not get the repository, which set a very clear signal that the winners were the ones who got the repository, because they've got 60 at least years of high-tech industry in their community with input of taxes and so on, yeah? So I thought that was a really good signal setting there.
Thank you, Charles. I just wanted to ask very quickly, are there any specific legal and or policy challenges or obstacles in the context of MNRs?
Oh, I'm frightened to even mention legal challenges with this bunch of smart lady lawyers in front of me, but obviously there are lots of them, yeah? There are some things which are often put forward as challenges which are not, however, so I'll be an optimist and start with these. The whole issue of transport and transboundary transport and so on is often put forward as, oh, this will never work, there'll be too much transport and you have to cross boundaries. That's not, as far as I understand, a legal problem. Even in a integrated community such as the European Union, then radioactive materials are goods like anything else, and there are overriding rules for about the free transport of goods between countries. So the transport is not the biggest issue there. But there are a whole lot of other issues, of course, at the detailed level, issues concerning liabilities. You know, what if something goes wrong during the preparation of the facility or after the facility's there? How do you share that? When does the full liability transfer to the host country? At some time in the future, it must do. Some of the pro-export countries, to put it that way, would like to insist that as soon as they ship the spent fuel, then they want all of the liabilities to go with it. Some of the objectors say, but other countries won't accept that. I don't think that has to be necessarily the case. I can think, and you, I'm sure any of you could teach me on this, I think that there are precedents for shared liabilities that can extend not just years, but even decades into the future. Countries which want to use a multinational facility, I do not believe they will instantly expect to be relieved of any liability. They might be very pleased to have a shared liability for a facility in another country rather than 100% liability for a facility in their own country, which they're having problems to implement. Yeah, so that that's one range of I think maybe the liabilities issue is the biggest one. And of course, at another level down again, and this is where I'm really out of my depth, so I won't go into it, is the whole financing and who does the financing and who's responsible and what happens if you need more money than you thought and what happens if you actually need less money than you thought and some of the paid-in money is excess. So there's a whole bundle of financial and legal things there.
So, Charles, speaking of multinational repositories, what are the status of such discussions in Europe? You've already shed some light on national repositories, but are there countries in Europe thinking about multinational solutions?
Yes, very much so, for some long time now. Starting with Europe, Europe is one of the more obvious regions of the world to start thinking about this, partly because there is a legal framework, an institutional framework already there with the EU in place. In addition, as I mentioned in response to another question, we have several countries in Europe with small countries with nuclear waste inventories, either because they have one or a few only nuclear power plants, or because they have no nuclear power plants, but in some ways even more urgent problems because they do still have some waste that has to go into a deep geological repository. So that in Europe, the countries have been working on this together for the RES Association, running for 20 years nearly now, 19 years, promoting the concept of multinational cooperation. And recently, the ERDO Association is also has been established at the beginning of this year. And again, that is a purely European organization. So that ERDO was based on the work of the ERDO Working Group, which lasted for 9 years, really. And now there's an association based in the Netherlands, which is purely trying to work towards finding a implementable solution for a multinational repository, which, of course, will involve finding a host country, which, as we mentioned, is going to be the most difficult part of all. But it's not just a European problem. It's a big issue. And RES, in fact, started out back then looking at three different regions in the world. Europe, which where we intensified efforts for the reasons I just mentioned, because one is that we know our way around here, and two is because of the framework being in place. The other was when in the MENA region, the Middle East, North Africa region, and the third was in Asia. And we've actually been at meetings in all of these regions. We've worked mostly in Europe, but we've had meetings in Tunisia and in Abu Dhabi in the Emirates, and also in Japan and in Singapore and in Bali, sometimes in collaboration with other organizations who are interested in the future of nuclear power in general, and included in that is the whole issue of how do you solve the back end issues. In your part of the world, for example, then participants have been there from Bangladesh, from Taiwan, from the Philippines, from Malaysia, from Vietnam, quite a lot of interest in Vietnam because they keep reviving their interest in potential nuclear power. And in Australia, of course, and Australia is a whole category on its own because Australia is the country in the last two decades which has twice had a major study on the question of whether Australia should in fact provide a multinational disposal facility as a service to other countries.
In your view, just so that we get a sense of where things are on a time horizon, how far do you think we are? How far away do you think we are from actually having a multinational repository solution materialize, Charles? I mean, is it tens of years? Is it more than that?
That's the most difficult question so far, yeah. There are different views on that. There is a strong body of opinion, which I do not totally subscribe to, which says that you're kind of wasting your time talking about timescales until several or at least a few national repositories are up and running, and so that it becomes an accepted technology. And I reluctantly agree there's some sense to that point of view. But of course, just having a system where waste has been delivered underground doesn't really prove anything for 10,000 years, yeah? Except it gives you confidence in the mechanics of doing it. So that maybe when these national repositories are in place, which will be 10 years, that might change some attitudes there. There's another issue which might lead to a multinational repository arising in a different way. And that's that some of these big national repositories, if they're operating, it might start to look, hey, this is just a normal job. And this becomes what we call the add-on approach, has been called by the IAEA. Add-on means you have a large repository anyway. You know, France, with its large numbers of nuclear reactors, will require a huge repository, of course, yeah. France also has a good business and would like to have an even better business reprocessing spent fuel from the many reactors around the world. So there are strong arguments, if you jump over the political opposition, for a country like France to do add-on. You know, it would be good for France, it would be good for the small countries that added on. So that's another way you might get a multinational repository in a relatively short timescale. If that doesn't happen, then the normal timescales for implementing repositories are always being pointed out, have been, as in the Finnish case, 20 years, more than 20 years, I think. Yeah, certainly, nearly 40 years from the beginning. 1980, the Finnish program predicted it would choose its site in 2002, 20 years ahead, and it kept it. It's the only example I can think of one of these disposal programs which has actually kept to the timescale that they said they would years ago. But it's measured in timescale of decades. So that another set of arguments is that if national repositories have taken that long, then multinational repositories must take at least as long. I, of course, am an unapologetic optimist, otherwise I wouldn't be doing this after all this time, yeah? And there's a final argument, the only positive one, is saying that just because this took 20 years or 30 years and 40 years doesn't mean that a new repository has to take the same, because a lot of the problems, especially the technical, engineering and scientific ones, have been solved. So that if somebody wants to do it, then they could do it fast.
Thanks very much, Charles. Something we haven't touched on in our discussion today, and that's small modular reactors. If you buy the promise that this technological innovation holds, there is the potential for SMRs to be deployed globally. What, in your view, does this mean for multinational repositories, Charles?
Just imagine the system. So these SMR are being delivered on trucks or barges or boats or something all over the world, yeah? And the recipients are being told, this is great, you only have 20 years before you have to do anything. They can learn for a long time, some of these SMRs, and then you can ship it back. But the SMR potential fabricators right now are being very quiet about what happens to the spent fuel that's in the SMR that is shipped back, yeah? And if you tell the small country that's getting the SMR, you only have 20 years, no worries for 20 years, you get all this electricity there, and not much maintenance, everything. But by the way, after 20 years, we deliver you back a chunk of highly radioactive material that has to be looked after for the next 100,000 years, then it kind of takes the shine off of the SMR, perhaps, for a small country. The countries which want to be suppliers of SMRs have got to get their act together and try to bring through the fact that when the waste comes back, the spent fuel comes back, they will treat it in their own country. And that could be difficult. I mean, that was the situation with reprocessing, as I'm sure you're aware, when France and Britain and to some extent Russia, they all provided reprocessing back in the 70s, yeah? And when the fuel came back to be reprocessed, then the high-level waste, the long-lived waste, stayed in France. And that was a large part of the attraction for many countries, including my second home country where I live, Switzerland. Even today, the countries which are, some countries which are still paying for expensive reprocessing are doing so because of the back end, not because of particularly they want to recycle, but they want the waste, the spent fuel, off of their own territory. Yeah? And unfortunately, as history showed, in France and in the UK, this very sensible system of keeping the high-level waste in France, because they have large amounts of it anyway, and the same for the UK, it broke down for purely societal reasons. I think that's the real issue with the SMRs. If you really want to spread them around a lot of place, then you have to address directly the final disposition of the spent fuel that's being produced in these SMRs. Currently, I think only Russia is doing that. I think there's no question in Russia with the SMRs that Russia is producing right now and using some of the on these floating SMRs. I think the idea is these definitely just go back to Russia, and you definitely do not send the spent fuel or any residues back to these remote communities, which the Russian program is supplying in the Arctic region, for example.
This has been a fascinating discussion, Charles. I've learned so much. It's deepened my understanding in an area that is still relatively new for us. So it leaves me to thank you on behalf of the Center for International Law for your time and all your precious insights. Thanks very much, Charles.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and I hope we can continue to interact on these crucial issues in the future. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to episode 9 of Nuclear Matters at CIL. Have a good day.